Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 107, where we will discuss an article by John Meyer and Brian Rowan titled Institutionalized Organizations, Formal Structure as Myth and Ceremony, published in the American Journal of Sociology in 1977. This is part one of the episode where we will present the author's arguments in the article that formal organizational structures tend to emerge as a result of institutionalized rules and not the other way around. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Pedro coming to you from Copenhagen.
Hi, this is Greta calling in from the south of the Netherlands, a city called Den Bosch.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Jose calling from Rotterdam in the Netherlands.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome especially to Jose Gallegos, who joins us for this episode on Institutionalized Organizations, Formal Structure as Myth and Ceremony by Meyer and Rowan, 1977. And Jose was one of those who suggested that we do this particular article. We're glad to have you here. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, for sure. So I'm originally from Mexico City. My background is actually in political science. I work for a while in the Mexican Congress. But then I moved to the management field and I'm specializing in organizational theory. My dissertation topic revolves around the evolution of working time trends. And I'm particularly interested in the institutionalization of the 40-hour workweek in the US, which I think is quite relevant now that there are so many trials and pilots aiming to move to a 4-day workweek. But first we need to understand how did we transition to a 5-day workweek. And that's how actually I started also exploring institutional theory. So I'm very thrilled about being here. I'm a big fan of this program. So yeah, I'm happy to discuss this paper with you all.
Well, thank you very much. And we're going to go ahead and give you first crack on the article, since it was your suggestion. Go ahead.
Perfect. So I would like to start by setting the context. This paper is published in 1977, but it's precisely in the late 70s when we see explosion of different theoretical frameworks in organizational theory. So not only institutional theory, but also resource dependence theory, population ecology. And I think it's important to set this background because institutional theory is going to try to explain some of the recurring topics of organizational theory in a different way. So there are these common questions of why organizations look so much alike, why certain organizational forms proliferate more than others, and to what degree managers and leaders can exercise agency in adapting organizations. And I think it's a really interesting contrasting point because, for instance, if we look at resource dependence theory, we see that Pfeffer and Salancik, they would say that, even though managers have some bounded rationality, they can still make strategic decisions such as what type of members they include in the executive board and how can that safeguard particular resources for the organization. In that sense, agency is something important, whereas for institutional theory in particular, Meijer and Rowan would make the argument that structures play a major role in how organizations look alike. And the agency of actors is usually constrained by these organizational expectations that come from the institutional environment. What managers or what leaders do is just enacting these institutional principles. And the more they align the organizations with these expectations, the more probabilities are that organizations will thrive in their environments. And that is also a contrasting point with populational ecology approaches, because it's not anymore the idea of organizations competing with each other, the idea of the fittest organization being reproduced by other firms. Efficiency is not anymore the main driver. And actually for Meijer and Rowan, they recognize that there might be organizations that are completely inefficient, and yet if they are aligned with the values of the environment, they will receive the legitimation that will enable them to get the resources they need. So I would like to introduce four main concepts that I think would enrich our discussion. The first one is precisely this idea of isomorphism that is present in this paper, but that is also hugely influential for future scholarship in institutional theory. So I'm thinking, for instance, DiMaggio and Powell that base their propositions on institutional isomorphism and, you know, their different determinants. So for Rowan and Major, this concept is important because that's how they explain how different organizations are, adopting the same organizational form. It's not the competition, it's not the survival of the fittest, it's rather the enactment of these myths and rituals. And I don't know about you, but in my my personal religious background, really made to pay attention to the selection of the words, because when they talk about rituals and myths and ceremonies, they choose a particular language that is, to me, it's quite interesting. Major, he will use later on with Jefferson other type of metaphors. So for instance, they will also refer to institutions as scripts, and they will literally understand actors as characters enacting the ideas or the script of a right player. But in this case, they use this set of metaphors that to me are really reflecting this idea of the religious experience. So when I was a child, I remember I was in the mass always asking myself the questions like, why is it, why is there a ritual for everything? A ritual for the clothes of the priest, for the moment in which we pray, in the moment in which you stand up, the moment in which you greet the other persons. When you ask the question, why is it codes and these procedures, you realize that there's no specific reason, and rather the ritual in itself has a value. So if we understand this from a Weberian perspective, Major and Rowan would say that it's a value rationality more than an instrumental rationality. And that's how they differentiate from other theories. And just a third element, which I think is also important, is the idea of legitimacy. And it's precisely bigger entities such as the state or structures such as globalization, multilateral organisms. They are the ones trying to establish particular good practices in accounting, in human resources, in many aspects that regulate our daily lives. And the more organizations are aligned with these principles, with this dictum, the more they can signal to the rest of actors that they are legitimate. And in that way, they are also trying to gain internal legitimation. They are trying to get certain stability in the way they interact with other actors. But it's so interesting that when I gave a second reading to this paper, I also realized that there is no one moment in which they conceptualize in a precise way what they understand by institutions. So for instance, they mention what the institutionalizing process is, and they say that institutionalization is the process by which organizational activities come to take on rule-like status in social thought and action. But they never define what an institution is as a construct, as an entity. And I think this is important for the future of institutional theory scholarship, because it's going to be a present discussion. What I do see is that they refer to external pressures such as legislation, professional standards, social expectations. And in that way, they also take a more sociological approach rather than psychological. So there are other institutional scholars who would try to define institutions by the taken for granted element, right? It's something that we recognize as a social fact that we don't question anymore and that we objectify. That is, for instance, the position that Zucker, in the same year, 1977, she tries to explore the micro foundations of institutional theory. But in this paper, Major and Rowan, they are more aligned with sociological perspective, mainly from Berger and Lukman in this book, the Social Construction of Reality, by which institutions are rather the typifications that we enact by the socializing process. So we get into society, we see how things work, we reproduce, we imitate those practices until there's a point in which they become part of our habitus, right? And in that way, we don't question those practices anymore. They don't emphasize as much the psychological element. So maybe the coupling concept, we can discuss it in a second round. But yeah, that would be for me the introduction to the paper.
This is very interesting. Thank you, Jose. I was trying to think how I would summarize some of what you said and some of what we read in one sentence. And I feel that what Meyer and Rowan were trying to do in this foundational paper is to say, like you said, that we should think less of organizations and their survival in terms of their technical superiority. So they're pushing away about Weber and bureaucracy and the forms that organizations take. What matters is not so much how they coordinate and accomplish their tasks, but that because they are in an environment that is, you know, their socially embeddedness, they need to worry about how much they fit what is expected for them to look like, right? What kind of practice they should have, what kind of form they should take. And they do that by taking cues from what are these myths and that populate such space. What this makes me think, and you were touching, I think, on something that is very fundamental, right? You talked about some key ideas like is isomorphism, legitimacy, rituals. But this very idea of what is this environment made of and what we should understand institutions to be, right, is I think maybe one place that we can start. Because some of my reading, and you reference Berger and Luckmann, is that almost the idea is that such environments, those myths, are almost cognitive, right? They're almost pre-awareness. They are just what is this ether that is around us that as members of society, we take for granted when we participate, when we use, right? But Meyer and Rowan, and again, rereading this paper with more care, as you point out, talks a lot about the normativity and some particular more concrete aspects of that. You know, they talk about rules and they talk about professions and so on. So I see that both seem to coexist in the text. And, you know, sometimes you read this for the first time and you read in a hurry and you end up reading through the lenses of the debates that you're familiar with. Rereading made me think that both seem to coexist, right? That they're referencing that organizations try to fit this environment and take a particular form given what they're trying to do, both because there is this aspect of this general cognitive ideas, what seems to make sense in such culture, but also the more concrete normative frameworks that are prevalent in such space. So maybe it's like this coexistence of these 2 points, something that we can maybe unpack a little bit.
Yeah, I think you did a great job giving a summary of the paper. And actually, I enjoy talking about the paper much more than reading it because it was so dry. And at the end of the day, I was like, oh gosh, like another page. Give me an example. And now it's coming to life as we're starting to talk about it. And we can start to use the vocabulary and have a conversation on processes in society that we see happening and perhaps that we see happening differently now than in 1977 when this paper was published, or perhaps the years before when they wrote it. I was also thinking, Pedro, what you mentioned about the environment. I was just thinking, like, what are other prominent theories that were prominent at that time? And population ecology, of course, is one. Resource dependency theory is another one that heavily draws on the concept of the environment and your dependencies as an organization on your environment, shaping how you act, how you behave, how you're structured. And now we have an institutional perspective, which this is one of the foundational papers of. And what I found interesting is that nowhere they give a really clear definition of what they see as the environment, but the environment is understood as being slightly different in each of these 3 cases. Like in population ecology, it's like kind of the field and who your competitors are, the survival of the fittest. So, you know, efficiency, effectiveness, productivity, and profit are key things that matter there. Then you have resource dependency theory that says, you know, when you're dependent on your environment for resources, it's important you maintain those relations and you shape them because they have an impact on you. And the organizations that know how to utilize strategic action towards their more powerful others are the ones that survive. Here, it's a very different narrative, right? And Pedro, and you say, you explained it very well, where it's really about how do you adapt to the expectations of how you will behave in the environment? And if you do that, how much legitimacy do you then gain? And how does that give you access to resources? But nowhere in the paper do they explain very well what the environment then is. Is it the society? Is it the government? Is it your organizational field? Like, it's very different. Like, even though they don't define it, it's very different from these other streams of research. And I found that very interesting.
Yeah, I wonder if that's not a well-thought-out, intentional act as well. Because, you know, if you define the environment, especially when you're trying to put forth something that truly is novel for its time, the environment, people can get distracted by it and start to question the new idea. Whereas my reading of it, I agree, it was dry. This was, and not only was it dry, this is one of those that reads very much like a piece for its time. It was entering a very specific conversation, and everybody who this was aimed at knew exactly what was being talked about. I had my own questions as to, okay, what did they mean by myth and ceremony? We'll get to that, I'm sure. But I was having to read this one paragraph at a time and say, okay, this statement makes sense to me. What is an example that I can draw from that helps illustrate this for me? My copy of it is marked up like heck with all of the examples that I came up with. And every single one of them had a different environmental, it was completely different in terms of its situation. Some societal, some organizational, some political, all of them basically operating on the same phenomenon. Maybe phenomenon's not the right word, but the same process by which something became a value that became legitimated and it begat a formal structure, or the other way around. Sometimes I was running into chicken and egg problems here. Was it the value that came first, or was it sort of the structure and we associated a mythology to it such that the myth lives on and the social structure lives on, like your example, Jose, of the church, but nobody knows what it means. So, so there's sort of like both a construction and a deconstruction aspect to this.
So I also thought that this could be by design, because what I thought is that when you have ambiguity, you create space, right? And of course, we'll talk about the incredible long shadow that this paper has generated and the amount of literature and research that exists. But I wonder if some of that was exactly purposefully left in such an open space. But I had a different reading than both of you, because what I found is that since there is today so much debate and examples and research on institutional theory, reading the original, so to speak, made me not just be able to, you know, relate all of these examples to where some of these concepts come from, but made me see that there is much more nuance than one would expect. Right. So that's what I was talking about, this whole idea that what is really an institution? Should we think it in more structural, sociological, normative versus more cognitive, social, psychological, phenomenological ways of thinking? Right. And I also found another interesting nuance is that in the paper, while, of course, they're making the argument that it's not just about survival, it's not about the technical capability of accomplishing the task, and they talk a lot about, you know, the coordination and the linking and the boundary spanning that the organization needs to do. It's about this legitimacy. They're also careful to say that maybe it's not all organizations, that this may matter differently in different situations, right? So they're trying to say, we have taken for granted that the survival is about the technical operations of the firm, but, you know, things take a value of their own, and being able to fit the environment is and can be the reason why organizations endure, right? So I think that was interesting also to see that it's a little bit more nuanced, the argument, and giving space that is not for all types of organizations in all types of situations. That is the only thing that matters, even though that is the argument they are putting forward in this particular moment.
Yeah, I think that precisely on this element of the nuances that they stipulate in their paper, one of those is that future scholars, so in this case, there's a paper by Oliver in 1991, she makes the connection between resource dependence theory and institutional theory. So at the beginning, I tried to present them as completely different research programs, but it's true, just as Pedro mentioned, that it's not only the myths and the institutions that influence organizations. So in this case, Oliver, she captures that there is this element of a strategy in which organizations are precisely trying to achieve specific purposes. They do have agency and they want to have access to resources, and yet they are constrained by the institutions. So I think the intersection is very well developed by future scholarship, because at the end, it's neither the fact that structures over determined organizations, and then there is no possibility for organizations to move away from the expectations of the institutions. And this is already in Major and Rowan, the section of decoupling. I think that it allows that possibility precisely because they recognize that sometimes organizations, they act as if they were following institutional principles, but actually they do something different, and there is never like a complete alignment that opens up the possibility of really having agency. And in this case, they explain it with another great sociologist, Goffman, the idea that they try to rehearse. Yeah, like a ceremony, right? They try to signal to the exterior that they are aligned with the procedures and the practices that the state, for instance, or a particular public agency is demanding. But at the end of the day, efficiency and profitability, they remain important elements to push the behavior of organizations. So they actually have to do both. On the one hand, they have to pretend that they are enacting these rituals, and they have to signal that they are part of the parish, of the same church. But on the other hand, they need to follow and to pursue their particular objectives. And I think that opens up the possibility for future researchers to discuss on that.
And I think another way that they describe the agency that organizations have is that, yes, indeed, there is like symbolic conformity, but there is also effort to lobby and to actively shape the myths that become pervasive and to shape them in a way to your advantage. So that was another one that they described. So this is actually what I really like about the paper. You mentioned it in your introduction. You say it's this idea that it's pretty much a process perspective. Like they talk about institutionalization, not institutions. It's not out there. It's kept in place there. In a way, they don't talk about it as much, but they do refer to kind of the power dynamics behind it. Why are these myths staying in place? What purpose do they serve? And why do organizations decide to adhere to it, either, you know, really comply with them or just symbolically?
So I was going to suggest that maybe we take some of these big concepts and start unpacking them a little bit. So maybe we can start with institutionalization, as you were just talking about that, Greta. And the first thing maybe I want to say is that I need to check the reference list for a second, but do reference TVA and Selznick, but it's very in passing. And it is not as, I don't know, I just had the expectation that it would be more of that, because we had Selznick here in a previous episode, right? And it's exactly the idea that a tool, a form, a structure may take a value beyond its instrumental value. So it becomes an end in itself. That was the idea of institutionalization for Selznick. And they are referencing that, or they're, you know, harking back at that, but therefore it's expanding, right? So I think that it's important to signal and recognize that this idea that exactly, that it's not just that organizations have a particular structure, a particular practice that they adopt because they're trying to use it for a particular purpose, but they're trying to signal legitimacy. I think the push is that Selznick was not as concerned with maybe the environment and didn't have such a more cognitive idea about the typifications and it taken for granted, right? Because he was even more processual in understanding how something comes to be seen in that organization as an end in itself, therefore institutionalized. And they're saying, well, a whole organization, the way it functions and the practice that they adopt can be such because it is in reference to what a particular environment takes for granted as a value in itself. So that is the analytical move, maybe in scale, in opening up the idea, considering the institutionalization on what for the field seems to be a value that signals legitimacy, which then is adopted by the organization. So I think it's an important thing just for, like, for the history of such concept and how it starts to be used and therefore what the literature then start to use is that to take a second to ponder.
To that point, I think, although I did say that it was dry and there weren't very many examples, the examples that were given were pretty good. And to your point about the institutionalization, page 350, this is pretty much the passage where the light bulb started to come on with me, because this is my total first time reading this. I have no background in this particular concept, so I'm coming in from a different perspective. I'll just read it. With the rise of modern medical institutions, large organizations that do not arrange medical care facilities for their workers come to be seen as negligent by the workers, by management factions, by insurers, by courts which legally define negligence, and often by laws. The costs of illegitimacy in insurance premiums and legal liabilities are very real. And this is a quoted paragraph. There's like an example of how what he's talking about with institutionalization that's very concrete and very relatable. And especially when you start talking about survival of the firm and efficiency, there's no question that, yes, you know, medical arranging such things is good for the business, it's good for the workers, et cetera, et cetera. But to the extent in which it got essentially put into a rule-based structure that says, if you don't, therefore you are negligent, is, I think, just capturing that essence of something that goes above and beyond what had been talked about previously. Now it's something that perhaps, you know, when we get into part two, it'll be something that we all understand and know because we think that way about how institutions behave, especially bureaucracies. But was novel at the time. It was not understood at the time.
I was just going to quickly say there is a great example of exactly this idea of institutionalization that is not just cognitive, but also normative, right? Because there is concrete impact if you don't follow that. So it's not just about being perceived as legitimate and appropriate, but also being perceived as, you know, correct in the very sense of the term.
I guess for them, the question is why the organizations follow these principles. Is it because they are really best practices that make the organizations more efficient? Or is it because they are expected to? Or, you know, the ultimate answer would be they don't even ask the question, why are we following these principles? They just follow them because they take them for granted. And I think they integrate these three explanations. But ultimately, the space that they are trying to open, if you really take institutional theory to the extreme, is that these organizations, ultimately, they are not even individual economic units having transactions with the environment. They are rather enactments of the institutions. So every component of an organization, the schedule, the accounting practices, human resources, everything is something that we enact from a particular legislation, from social expectations, you know, even the way we regulate relationships at work, whether we allow or not romantic relationships, when do we prepare for retirement, all these things are institutionalized. And this is not a characteristic of a particular field, but rather it's a characteristic of modernity. And to me, this is the big claim that they are trying to make, because what they are trying to characterize is a particular episode in human history in which the rationality of organizations, these basics of Weber, in which individuals are trying to set principles for every single element of behavior, is taken to the extreme, in which now we inhabit a world in which everything we do within organizations has been determined by some form of authority. Now, this is, of course, taken to the extreme, right? As Pedro mentioned, there are more nuances in the text. This provocative element of trying to think that not only efficiency is not important, but perhaps even if it's inefficient, as long as it's aligned with the rest of social expectations, it's something positive for the organization.
Those are great points. And I wanted to highlight another sub-narrative in this paper, which I thought Pedro in particular might have an opinion about, formal organization. And that's actually, you know, the illustration that is used in the paper, where they say, you know, as societies are getting more complex in their social structures, we also organizations are becoming increasingly more complex in their structures and formalized. I was thinking about that. And I'm sure you have an opinion about that, Pedro. But what we see nowadays, for instance, is the rise of agile as a new form of organizing, not only in software development, but you see agile being implemented in R&D contexts, for instance, in many different settings. And it's almost like a new institution of the time to get rid of the formal and institute a new set of practices. And I just had a conversation with a friend about it, like how he has to do all these courses. And he's like, why do I have to do this? Like, this is completely not related to the nature of our work, which was exactly the point that Meyer and Rowan made in the paper, that the institutionalization of things in the society leads to a disconnect between the structure of the organization and how the work is taking place. So I was wondering, if we look now, what is happening at the moment with, for instance, the introduction of agile, or think, for instance, like our assumptions about when we work, thinking about the 5-day work week or on-site, remote, like what are the structures in place that are becoming dominant now, and where do they come from? And are they the neo-formal organization, or is that this a counter movement?
Following on that last point, what I'm wondering is, to what extent are we finding instances where these institutionalized values are in conflict, or we find organizations caught between two of them? And I'll give an example with education. So on the one hand, it has become an institutionalized norm that you need greater and greater credentialism for things that didn't require credentialism before. So you see a lot of people in the States pursuing degrees, bachelor degrees, for things that really don't require it, but have become necessary in order to be competitive for a job. If you don't have the degree, then there's not somebody, you know, something that is validating that you know something about the job. Then the counter value is exactly what you're saying, of some traditional sense of efficiency of why are we doing what we're doing, which would argue for the other direction. And who's in the middle, of course, is colleges are trying to balance these two, because they've got students now who are coming in wanting to basically get what they need, get the degree in a much less period of time without all of the noise and unnecessary stuff. We got online. So you have different values that are competing, and the organization is kind of in the middle.
So on the formal structure, I'm going to rewind a little bit, because Tom, I think that some of this complexity of values, we can talk more in the part two, right? Because I think there's something about the pluralistic nature of the environment that we live in. So I'm going to rewind to what Greta was saying. And I think that my usual quick answer about what is happening to formal structures is that maybe it's just changing and becoming more invisible or more apparent, but I don't think it's just necessarily disappearing. Agile itself is one way to formalize work, right? Maybe it's more colorful. It appears as more modern, so therefore we don't experience as such, right? I have the same thing with holacracy. You know, all of these things is basal formalization of roles, but maybe they are dynamic. Or there's a lot of the things that we don't use organizational charts in terms of, you know, writing them on paper, but they are encoded in so many digital systems in the way in which, for example, when you have to get a reimbursement from an organization, you have to go through particular channels and get particular approvals. So some of this, I think, has been encoded, which generates new questions because the types of decoupling becomes a bit different. And that's where I would like to go. I already said the word, which is interesting that in trying to say, okay, organizations are not just trying to accomplish their tasks, they need to fit what is expected. And they say, well, the myth and ceremony comes in that they maybe are trying to do that, but it's not necessarily that they change the operational core to what they do. That's the whole idea. They try to preserve that. So, you know, if you think about the case of any kind of new norm, new expectation, new practice, you may use, let's use the case of the agile, right? So it's going to be used, yes, but maybe for particular tasks, right, that are not so much core. Imagine if you're following the idea of Meyer and Rowan, they would say, okay, for the key things about R&D, they're still going to continue to be organized in the more traditional way in which it was done. But for maybe the smaller tasks, more minor tasks, or for particular things, that is when we would see that. Because the idea is that you protect the technical core and you decouple, right? That's another important concept they introduce, that to preserve the way in which you do things that's supposed to help you achieve the goals of the organization, but he introduces other things as a different layer. And they talk about decoupling, and the other idea is also the one of confidence and good faith. And they talk about that because that is the paramount ways in which, you know, in their conceptualization, you resolve these inconsistencies that exists in trying to follow the logic of efficiency and doing what makes sense versus trying to fit what categorically is expected given the attempt to achieve legitimacy, right? So maybe something that we can unpack a little bit more as well.
Yeah, I think it's important how they shift from efficiency to this element of good faith that Petro mentioned, because there might be some overlap. I do see that they conceive institutions as cognitive shortcuts, because there's a point or there are certain areas in the organization that you cannot falsify. You know, if you make the claim or if you make the hypothesis of a particular practice being more efficient, if there is a practice, for instance, opening a Title IX office to reduce sexual harassment, to what extent does that have an economic rationality, and how can you measure the profit or the benefits of the organization for having that specific office that maybe the government is demanding? So there are a lot of instances in which you cannot measure how productivity or efficiency is improved by particular practices, and yet the organization has to enact it. Now, there is more inefficient if you don't internalize the institution, because then there are costs in your environment, right? You will be judged, and maybe the authority can enforce a particular law. But it is interesting that both the organization, but also the authority in place, they don't have incentives to enforce or to deviate from the norm. So that allows, you know, a point of convergence in which the organization is going to accept whatever the environment is demanding, and the agency is going to make the least effort possible to enforce a particular law or order, right? Even though they are not explicitly mentioning the element of efficiency, they provide an explanation of why this is still good for everyone. Why is everyone gaining something out of following these institutionalized principles? And it's also interesting that Tom mentioned the academic field, because neo-institutional theory, or they also call it organizational institutionalism, it starts here in Stanford, and it starts in a research program that is really focused on how education has been standardized in the last decades, not only in the US, but worldwide. And from that point onwards, there are a lot of scholars within institutional theory that are really trying to make sense of, for instance, why the curricula is so standardized in different universities around the world, or why do we follow certain procedures like the SAT or the GRE to make sure that, you know, we have the qualifications to be accepted into university. So if there is a place that is heavily institutionalized, that is for sure academia and in general higher institutional education. And just one last thing that I found very curious, like, I didn't know that Rowan was a student of your major, and he was actually in his third or fourth year of the PhD when he was writing this paper with major. So that gives me a lot of hope as a PhD candidate, but it also tells you how there is this research group in Stanford. There is also Scott, then Patricia Thornton, she will develop this idea of institutional logics. So Tom was talking about what happens when there are two different institutions in conflict. Well, Patricia Thornton has all this explanation of how that also provides a space for agency, right? And organizations can decide upon that. But it's interesting that this is something more organic of different scholars really coming together and trying to create a new perspective on how organizations work.
We'll probably expand more on the lineage that came from the paper later, but I think it's interesting to underscore that every theory paper has, I think, an example or a research or in mind, right? And I think it's very clear. It's good that you pointed out that higher education is kind of the implicit model in which many of these things are coming from, and the ideas that are being put forward.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.